Domenica stilled the impulse to raise the matter of a Nash spy swap while still in bed with Putin, chiefly because the president was not susceptible to post-coital euphoria. After sex, the evening wasn't over, for the president uncharacteristically lingered to chat, so Domenica padded around her spacious new kitchen in a black V-neck knee-length cotton slip with one spaghetti strap carelessly hanging off the shoulder and her hair tied with a ribbon. She didn't wear a black satin thong underneath in case Volodya fancied kitchen counter sex. Number 81, bechamel thickens only with stirring, before he left. Sitting on a modern bar stool in Dominica's deluxe kitchen of stone and wood, Vladimir Putin was content. The headlines about Audrey Rowland's arrest did not overly concern him, as grievous a loss as it was. Lurid news like this was good for Russia's image, was good for his image as Muzhestvenye, the virile leader who ran spies around the world. The world would know that the secret services of Russia were omniscient apex predators that could penetrate the governments of his enemies, discover their secrets, and exert his will over them. Of course, spies could suffer reverses, but Putin enjoyed seeing foreigners, governments or companies or individuals, moderate their behaviors in fear of his wrath. His active measures were creating lasting discord in the West at minimal cost, and if he wanted to unseat an American politician, he had only to release an embarrassing unencrypted email through WikiLeaks, run by that languid dupe hiding in that exiguous Latin embassy in London. Partisan political hysteria now gripping American society would do the rest. And he was having his bullish way with Igorova, a delectable bonus. He looked at Dominika's legs as she reached for an upper cabinet and saw how the ballet dancer's calf muscles flexed when she was on tiptoe. He did not at all mind the whispered gossip in the Kremlin already swirling in the hallways that the two of them were bedmates. No one would dare utter such gossip aloud, and it simply validated that the SVR belonged to him, just as the FSB belonged to him, just as the Siloviki belonged to him. To go with the Georgian champagne she had opened, Domenica assembled a quick Mediterranean appetizer with ingredients available only at the special government commissary on the ground floor of her building. Marinated artichoke hearts with capers and olives on bruschetta under the broiler. A contorno she first tasted in Rome while meeting with Nate. They were newly in love then, and had fed each other with their fingers, giggling and drinking asti. It occurred to her that her thoughts always returned to her Nate. Take care, lest the Tsar sees it in your face. She bent to take the tray out of the oven, feeling his eyes on her haunches. Time for her pitch. She was better at this than he was, but she had to be careful. She reverted to more formal address.
Mr. President, given the events of the last 4 days, I have a suggestion I would like you to consider, said Domenica.
Putin sipped a glass of champagne she had poured for him.
I recommend that the American be moved from Butyrka to a special safe house, where he could be kept under close supervision, and where low-level interrogation by a team of minders could continue without interruption.
Putin looked sideways at her. Why would we spare the American the discomfort of prison? He asked.
CIA was not above mounting a rescue operation at the Black Sea compound. I would hate for them to try the same thing in Moscow. It would not be impossible. Prison guards are paid little and many are corrupt.
Putin looked at Dominica's figure under the sheer black slip, faint blue veins traversing her cleavage. The savory artichoke heart sizzling out of the oven smelled delectable.
We can discuss the matter at the meeting tomorrow morning. I want to talk to the three of you at 8 o'clock to discuss all the security variables, he said.
There was a reason he had lingered in her apartment, sipping champagne and watching the swell of her buttocks as she moved around the kitchen. Putin knew facts the others did not know, and he intended to make tomorrow's meeting unpleasant because things needed shaking up, perhaps including some purges and firings. He'd done it before to his counsel, and it was time again. The shaking up, in General Igorova's case at least, could start tonight. He reached and grabbed her hair, pulling her close to him, looking at her eyes. Domenica kept her unblinking gaze steady,
and let him wrap his fingers in her hair, imagining delivering a single ballistic slap, a systema strike against his jaw. Was he going to push her head into his lap? He held her wrists behind her back with one hand and pulled her closer, so their lips touched. He popped an appetizer into his mouth and smiled. Dominica felt the rage well up inside her gut, yet she resisted the elemental urge to push away from this neznatnye, this jack-in-the-office commoner with imperial airs. If he wanted her mouth in his lap, she'd use her teeth and spit his severed manhood into his face as he chewed hors d'oeuvres. Wait. This is 5 minutes of humiliation. In the end, you'll bring him down. But the next morning in the conference room with the furious Putin, the situation changed. Dominika's love talk, she had cooed Kroshka, baby, puppet, sugar to him last night, was a distant memory, her sore crotch forgotten. He was once again the blue-eyed caliph, playing it heavy and serious.
Magnet is blown. A valuable asset prepared over a dozen years compromised, yelled Putin. And none of you had the wit to manage the case to prevent her arrest.
He slammed his hand hard on the table theatrically. Patrushev of the oily yellow halo sat back in his chair. Dominica waited for the inevitable prevarication. Nikolai looked back and forth between the president and his colleagues.
Mr. President, Anton Gorelikov's treason and defection could not have been foretold. Magnet was his case, and he did not share operational details. He had not even briefed Igorova yet. Once Anton revealed all to his CIA paymasters, no operation of ours could remain secure. We must complete a full damage assessment regarding the extent of his knowledge. He was aware of a great deal.
Dominika's scalp twitched. Patrushev obliquely was criticizing Putin himself for trusting Anton so much. Putin stared at the three of them.
My brilliant Tsar Dvoretti. My loyal courtiers, he said, thick with irony.
Gorelikov did not defect. He was kidnapped, he said matter-of-factly. The conference room was quiet as the three of them stayed still, wondering if Putin's penchant for reading minds and for seeing the future was just now psychotically manifesting itself. Dominika held her breath and wondered how he knew. Did that mean he also suspected her? Finally, Bortnikov spoke.
Kidnapped by whom? Mr. President, with all due respect, it's an outlandish theory.
Kidnapped, taken hostage, assassinated, it makes no difference, said Putin angrily.
We have been the target of a massively diabolical operation by CIA, a deception unparalleled since the height of the Cold War.
The Tsar was schooling his professionals. Bortnikov's FSB was responsible for internal security. How did the president know this? This was FSB turf, his territory. His halo pulsed in agitation.
What deception, he said.
Putin snorted in derision at his useful fools. CIA removed Gorelikov, shot, poisoned, threw him to the sharks, it does not matter. So we would conclude the inevitable.
This is an impossibility, said Bortnikov. You know how operations are conceived and implemented. You know the main enemy. How can you possibly believe?
Putin held up his hand.
CIA removed Gorelikov to make us believe he is Chalice and that he defected.
Magnet's arrest came immediately afterward, a well-timed coincidence, no? But I am telling you this categorically. Gorelikov cannot be the mole. Chalice is still among us. Without knowing why, Patrushev was nodding in agreement like a felt-headed dipping bird toy sold in kiosks in Gorky Park.
On what do you base this theory? Asked Bortnikov, struggling to retain a modicum of deference.
Dominika could see he was furious with Patrushev, a natural podkalim, a real lickspittle.
A single fact, said Putin. Gorelikov conceived of, planned, and managed the cataclysm operation to eliminate Alex Larsen.
Silence. All of them looked at Putin in shock. They knew everything that went on in the Russian Federation, but none of them had heard of this before.
Eliminate Larsen?
My God. Dominika knew she had just heard the most explosive secret intelligence of the decade. Kremlin complicity in the allegedly accidental death of the American DCIA.
Gorelikov planned the death of Larsen, she whispered. Do the Americans know? There will be bedstvie, calamity over this.
When I tell them, Dominika thought. Putin did not care. He smirked at their discomfort and his halo shone. Was he not the Tsar? Did he not rule Novorossiya? No asset under the control of CIA would undertake the assassination of its own director without warning Langley and disrupting the plot, he said. Other services might martyr their own, but never the Americans. The Chinese, perhaps, the North Korean, certainly, and Stalin without a second thought, but not the Yankees.
So the real chalice is active, said Patrushev, not dwelling on the enormity of cataclysm or statal murder. He seemed eager to please the president, eager to agree.
Putin nodded. It is clever. We all assume Gorelikov is chalice, therefore the real chalice is safe. You all know the game. We've run such deceptions ourselves. Alex Larsen's death proves Gorelikov could not be an American asset. His success in cataclysm exonerates him.
And chalice? Muttered Patrushev.
Putin's face changed from smirking narrator to phlegmatic prosecutor. The three of you must ask each other that question, said Putin, staring at them.
Mr. President, what are you saying? Said Bortnikov, sitting stock still.
That he suspects one of us, thought Dominika. It's a wonder he didn't pass out pistols loaded with blanks to see who would shoot whom.
All right. What would Braddock do? What would he tell you?
If you don't keep calm, if you don't share the outrage, they'll suspect you.
Like a sleepwalker heading toward the edge of a cliff, Dominika heard herself speak.
The American officer Nash is the key. He certainly knows important details, doubtless even the true identity of Chalice. It is time for enhanced interrogation to begin.
Idiotka. You better pray you haven't signed his death sentence.
Putin nodded with satisfaction. Let it be so. And no more talk of comfortable safe houses or spy swaps, he said, pointing his finger at Dominika. You are in charge, but I want all three of you there, in the room. I want that name the American hides behind his teeth. I don't care how you get it, but get it. The medical team is already at Butyrka waiting. Go now.
They all knew they had to out Herod, to prove their innocence. With Putin, demonstrable innocence didn't matter. He just wanted to blame someone.
That month, Lucius Westfall officially joined the Directorate of Operations and soon would be going through operational training at the farm, as Nate and Gable and Forsyth and all of them had done before him. After the farm, Westfall was scheduled to begin Russian language training in preparation for his first tour in Moscow. The irony did not escape either Benford or Forsyth as they looked on benevolently. As a renewed, rather frantic search for replacement candidates for CIA director roiled the political waters of Washington, D.C., Acting Director Farrell summoned Benford to his office. I'm told by Senator Feigenbaum's former staff director, Rob Farbison, that you obviously and deliberately misled the DCIA candidates during their preparatory briefings, and that you withheld asset information from them, said the director. Duchin from Congressional Affairs corroborates Farbison's accusations. You were expressly ordered to brief the candidates completely and fully without reservation. He straightened the blotter on his otherwise spotless desk. We were conducting a counterintelligence investigation, said Benford with infinite weariness. I was convinced after an exhaustive investigation that one of the three candidates for the job was working for Moscow. It turned out I was right. We were 48 hours from having a Russian mole as director of the agency. It was the reason Alex Larsen was assassinated.
Farrell scoffed. You can't leave Larsen alone. You're preposterous.
That is speculation, but it does not excuse you from your dereliction, said Farrell, or from your insubordination. Benford, you've been an irascible, uncontrolled rogue your entire career. Why is that, do you think?
Benford shrugged. I don't know, he said. I suppose, unlike you, I never got accustomed to the taste of cock. Farrell sat up, red-faced, and slammed his fist on the desk. That will do, he yelled. You're fired, effective immediately, separated from the service. Go to that rat hole you call an office and collect your personal items, and two officers from security will escort you out of the building. You can surrender your badge to them and good riddance.
Benford left the director's office without another word, but by the time the two blue blazers escorted him through the turnstile at the north entrance, 200 employees were lined up along the length of the atrium, applauding. Benford scowled at the crowd and waved once, then turned and unclipped his badge from his torn jacket pocket, handed it to one of the security men, and went through the automatic doors, which hissed closed behind him. From that instant forward, Simon Benford could have entered CIA headquarters no more easily than could Vladimir Putin. Dominica's Artichoke Appetizer. In a large bowl, toss marinated artichoke hearts, pitted Kalamata olives, capers, quartered tomatoes, and crushed garlic with white wine, olive oil, salt, and pepper. Spread out and roast on a baking sheet until tomatoes are tender. Drizzle with olive oil, sprinkle with salt, and top with torn basil leaves. Serve on toasted bruschetta. Chapter 39. Interview Room 3. Butyrka Prison. Nate was escorted downstairs from his cell by two guards who were careful not to jostle his left arm in a short cast or his little finger swaddled in a splint, which was good because his whole left side ached. Nate was surprised when they did not enter a standard ground floor interrogation room with the usual table, steel chairs, and photographs of Marx and Lenin, and the ubiquitous bowl of roses, which of course concealed the microphones. Instead, they descended to the clammy third basement, with the flaking pale green walls and the chipped steel doors that gave no clue what or who languished behind them. Nate thought he must be the first CIA officer to be marched down this windowless corridor. It was utterly silent as the guard stopped him in front of a door marked Opros 3, Interview Room 3. Some interview room. The room was large and looked like a surgical theater with white tiles on the floor and up the walls above chest height. It smelled of disinfectant and was lighted a dazzling white. Several wheeled tables were aligned against the far wall and massive circular stainless steel pole lights, also on casters, were gathered in a corner. Against the opposite wall there was a strange solitary chair that looked as though it was made of painted aluminum, with a high back and headrest, flat protruding arms, and rolling casters on the legs. The white paint on the chair was chipped and discolored, especially along the front legs, the arms, and the high back. Standing alone in a corner of the room, the chair looked like a discarded 18th-century baby's high chair, wheeled aside and forgotten. As he was marched in, Nate saw a makeshift gallery of 5 wooden chairs set up behind him. Interrogations normally did not have audiences, but perhaps these were for interrogator trainees learning the finer points of their trade. It was typical Russian beastliness that observers were placed inside the room to hear, see, and smell the proceedings firsthand, rather than behind one-way glass. The guards pushed Nate into a wooden straight-back chair and stood behind him, their hands resting lightly on each of his shoulders. Nash saw the prison guards carried OTS-27 British 9mm automatic pistols and holsters on their belts. He leaned forward to peek around the guards at the rest of the room, but was yanked back to sit up straight. There were glass-fronted medicine cabinets filled with vials and surgical instruments neatly laid out on sterile cloths. There was also a stainless steel table in the center of the room with drainage pipes at either end, leading down to drains in the floor, clearly a mortician's table for performing autopsies. Nate did not like the look of the undulating tile floor gently sloping toward half a dozen drains around the room. He also didn't like the look of a truck battery on a dolly, with a jumble of cables wrapped around the handles, barely visible, leaning against the side of the cabinet. The equipment was incongruous in the gleaming surgical theater. It belonged in a grimy motor pool garage meant for jumping stalled trucks, not in this room.
Nate's spirit fluttered a little as he imagined what the battery was for. Ignore the damn thing. Despite his arm and his finger, Nate was in relatively good shape. He had figured out that Benford had probably run a canary trap and had told the three DCIA candidates variants of the same story. With luck, Dominica had passed the word to Langley, hopefully in time to prevent a catastrophe. Nate accepted that this was Benford's radical all-out tactic to expose the mole, and he understood he was being used as a lizard's tail, an expendable operative who is jettisoned and sacrificed to protect larger equities. He had not seen Dominica since the interrogation in a little cottage on Putin's compound, and he was worried that the mole had somehow compromised her. He was also worried about Agnes and hoped she was safely out of Russia. No. If everyone was blown, he reasoned, it wasn't likely they'd be putting him through the ringer. He still had agents to protect. If he listened closely, Nate expected he could passively glean an idea from the interrogator's questions about the status of the mole hunt and of Dominica's security situation. Avoiding looking at the battery, Nate tried to prepare himself mentally and physically for the coming cycle of interrogation. They probably would try drugs again, but with luck and discipline, Nate thought he could resist. If Dominica had any influence in managing the interrogation, he knew she would contrive to keep the physical punishment at a minimum and to limit the sessions for as long as possible as Langley worked on arranging a swap. She must not go too far on his behalf and throw suspicion on herself, however. That was critical. Whatever the Russians had in mind, he had no doubt he would survive. He was a prisoner in Putin's Moscow, but this was the modern age, and intelligence officers from opposition services were not harmed according to a strict protocol. Putin may have eliminated hundreds of dissident Russians, but not ops officers of rival services. Nate knew he had a long stretch ahead before the State Department would get off their pinstriped fannies to commence talks to arrange for his release. He could be in the slammer for a year, 5 years, 10 years, but CIA would never give up trying to get him back. On his return to Langley, there would be medals, a promotion, choice of assignments, but in reality, his career would be over. He would be considered too burned cover-wise and too burned out psychologically. By then, he daydreamed, Dominica might be finished at SVR and would be ready to retire and disappear into idyllic resettlement with Nate. It was a hell of a long way around to finally start a new life together, but it would be worth the wait. For the present, Nate intended to give his interrogators as much guff as he could muster. He knew by now the Russians probably had identified him as Nathaniel Nash, the last handler of General Korchnoi, one of the best assets the CIA had run in Moscow for 14 years. They would also know that Nash was a fluent Russian speaker, which would further infuriate them. All thoughts about civilized outcomes in the basement of Butyrka prison evaporated when Sergeant Josip Blokin walked into interview room 3. He was dressed in a camouflage utility uniform and wore polished combat boots. A green nylon web belt was cinched tightly around his waist with a metal snap buckle with the Spetsnaz seal of parachute and dagger. His uniform was starched and crisp, but nowhere was there any badge of rank. His thin hair was slicked back over his bullet head, his scarred forehead dully shone in the bright lights of the room, and his ham-hock hands hung at his sides. He approached Nate's chair and leaned close so that their faces were inches apart. Blokin inexplicably smelled of kerosene, sharp and crisp, not altogether unpleasant.
"It is Sudba meeting again, American." "How do you say it in English?" said Blokin in his gravelly croak.
"Fate," said Nash in English. "Been back to Turkey since we last spoke?"
"Not just fate, Yankee," said Blokin. "Sudba also means doom."
Nate looked him in the face. "Yours or mine? Or Major Shlikov's?" Blokin signaled to the guard standing behind Nate's chair to pick him up and put him into the antique, chipped high chair and wheel it into the center of the room, under a big surgical light. The guards cinched Nate's wrists to the flat arms of that chair and his ankles to the fronts of the legs with clear plastic cable ties, which Blokin strained tight. Nate's felt slippers were yanked off his feet. A sweat-stained leather strap was passed around his chest and buckled in back. It was tight, but Nate could breathe okay. It dawned on him that this might be worse than he'd anticipated. These restraints suggested they were going to try extreme techniques that would make him fall out of his chair if he weren't tied in. Perhaps he'd be the first CIA officer in the history of the Cold War to actually be tortured in the Butyrka basement. Maybe they'd give him a Trailblazer award when he got home. He tested the ties and rocked in his chair, sending it slowly rolling across the uneven floor, just as the door opened and four people walked in, three men and a woman, all senior bigwigs, judging by the way the guard snapped to attention. Nate craned his head to see. The woman was Dominica, dressed in a dark suit and dark stockings. A prison visitor's badge was around her neck, and it swung as she walked, her heels clicking unevenly against the white floor tiles because of her slight limp. It was like a dream seeing her now, here, like this. Her hair was up, as always, and their eyes met for an instant. It would have been the most natural thing for her to walk up to his chair, kiss him on the lips, order his bonds cut, and walk him out of this basement and through the front gates while holding his hand. She'd give him some cren, some grief, like, "Dushka, you cannot manage even this without my help?" He smelled a faint whiff of her Kalesh perfume in the room over the stench of carbolic disinfectant. He heard the scrapes of chairs behind them as Bloken pulled Nate's chair back into the middle of the room so he couldn't see the visitors. Nate had also immediately recognized Bortnikov and Patrushev, former and current directors of FSB. Dominica completed the trifecta as director of SVR. These officials were here to observe his interrogation? Unheard of. Maybe the Kremlin was panicking, or maybe Benford had bagged Magnet, and they didn't know how and were desperate to identify the American mole. Nate told himself he had to be extra careful. The mole was sitting in this very room, the one with the pretty legs. He had to protect her at all costs. Nate couldn't know it was more serious than that. After being berated by Putin and informed that Gorelikov was not the mole, the three service chiefs had been escorted to their official cars and had separately driven to Butyrka to observe the interrogation of the American case officer. They instinctively stayed apart to avoid contamination, and they did not speak to one another. Dominika's head was in a fog. She did not remember the drive to the prison through Moscow streets, did not remember the tea served in the protocol room by the prison director, did not remember the clacking footsteps echoing down endless corridors and littered stairwells. Her head cleared when she entered the white-tiled room and saw Nate in the chair, his purple halo shining brightly. Her stomach flipped when she saw Bloken and his black wings waiting to begin. This was another Putin touch, using Bloken. He hated Nate for what had happened to Shlikov and, most of all, for the towering insult of pitching him in the Turkish jailhouse. He would put greater energies into Nash's interrogation. The halos of her colleagues were bleached out with fear. This exercise was like some throwback to the great purges of the 30s. All were suspected and accused. One trusted advisor would be destroyed, and the others exonerated. Bloken had put on a full-length leather slaughterhouse apron and tied it tightly around his waist. He pulled on heavy black rubber gloves, then wheeled the battery from the corner of the room and uncoiled the cables. A red star was embossed on the side of the battery. The cable ends were clamped to the battery terminals. The opposite ends terminated in dull copper alligator jaws that were wrapped in red felt, which Bloken dipped into the bucket of water, soaking the felt wraps thoroughly. He touched the felts together, but no Hollywood sparks dramatically arced and snapped. Instead, the felts started smoking from the current, quenched by Bloken's dipping them into the bucket again. There was a sour, metallic, burned toast smell in the room. Nate heard a chair scrape behind him and willed Dominica to stay still. How long could he last? How long would Domi stay in her seat? Come on, baby, hang tough. Bloken casually leaned against the arm of Nate's chair.
"I require one thing from you, Amerikansky," he said softly. The name of your agent in Moscow. Nate smiled at him. The name's a secret malice, you small prick. That's why we use the word agent.
Bloken's eyes narrowed and his face flushed. He touched a felt pad to each side of Nate's left ankle and looked as Nate's back arched and his left leg involuntarily shot out straight. The electric shock was excruciating, half hammer blows and half pulsing muscle spasm that engulfed his whole leg. Shit, this could go on for days. Bloken removed the felts, and the sudden cessation of pain and spasm was a heavenly relief, but anticipating the next one was enough to drive one mad, which was the point of using shock, the prisoners dreading the next jolt. Bloken dipped the felts in the water again.
The name of the mole. We have all day and all night until the battery goes dead or you lose your mind, whichever will come first.
Nate remembered how good Bloken's English was. Nate shook his head to clear it. You're an ass-picking gorilla, Manjuk dickhead. With a snarl, Bloken pressed the felts on the insides of Nate's thighs, an inch from his scrotum. Nate's torso curled forward in a rigid bow against the chest strap, and his lower body started shaking spasmodically, the current running through his skeletal muscle fibers triggering synchronous contraction. The pain between his legs was all-encompassing, radiating through his penis, which immediately stood straight up, followed by a loss of bladder control. Bloken removed the felts and stood back, avoiding the trickle of urine under Nate's chair. The American raised his head, straightened, and looked at Bloken through wet hair which had fallen over his eyes.
I require the name, Yankee, said Bloken.
Nate shook his head. He couldn't take much more of the felts, and he was terrified that Dominica would soon react to save him. Only one hope. Piss Bloken off so much that the Spetsnaz sergeant would either kill him or so seriously damage Nate that the interrogation would cease, at least temporarily, thus distancing Dominica from a catastrophic reaction. The button would be Bloken's honor. Give it a try. Hurry. Save her. His crotch burned and his thighs twitched uncontrollably. During the last spasm, it felt as if he had pulled a muscle in his back. This is why we pitched you in Istanbul, said Nate hoarsely in Russian, to give the insult more edge. You are no man of honor, certainly not worthy of belonging to the Spetsnaz Brotherhood.
Tajenchina, you are a woman.
If he ever got out of this, Domi would be sure to give him grief over that. Loken's eyes goggled at the insult and he cast aside the battery cables, kicked over the battery cart, spilling the water bucket, walked over to a cupboard and drew out a meter length of rebar. His eyes were unblinking, like a lizard's eyes, and his scarred forehead was a livid purple. For what we are about to receive, thought Nate, looking at Bloken's face. Bloken hit him with the length of the steel bar across his left shin, causing a comminuted fracture of the tibia, shattering the bone into several pieces inside the leg, and tearing the interosseous membrane that stabilizes the tibia and fibula, essentially rendering Nate's left leg below the knee the approximate consistency of cooked pasta. Nate roared in pain, but it was a throaty roar of defiance, not the keening wail of a terrified prisoner. Nate looked at Bloken as he roared, as if he would tear his throat out with his teeth, but the blocky trooper was unfazed. He handled the ribbed length of the rebar in both hands lovingly, like Benny Goodman held his clarinet. Bloken appraised Nate's left leg, which was already swollen and purple, and bent unnaturally to one side. Nate could feel the grooves in the arm of the chair as he dug his nails into the soft aluminum. Other men and women had clawed against the pain as he was doing now. For all Bloken's many talents for mayhem, sophisticated interrogation was not his specialty.
"I require the name of the Russian traitor working for the Americans," he said.
Nate lifted his sagging head, and a bead of sweat dropped off his nose. Pain radiated up his leg to his gut.
"You're supposed to ask the first question before you hit the prisoner Zhopa, asshole," he whispered.
Faster than Nate could tense up, Bloken brought the rebar down on Nate's captive left hand, re-breaking his little finger, shattering 3 of 5 metacarpophalangeal joints where the digits meet the palm, and pulverizing the small bones of the intercarpal articulation of the wrist. Nate's ruined hand swelled immediately, and his knuckles became dimples. The pain was overwhelming, sharp, electric, radiating up his arm to his armpit and across his chest, the associated nerves reacting to the crushing blows of the steel bar. Roaring like an animal made him hyperventilate and help the pain. The cable tie on his left wrist was now cutting into his flesh as his hand turned purple. Nate growled as Bloken leaned close, coyly resting the tip of the rebar on Nate's undamaged right forearm, a hint of more to come.
"The name of your asset in Moscow?" asked Bloken.
"Someone close to the top," stuttered Nate. "But I cannot recall the name, so fuck you." Through his pain, Nate heard the three senior officials behind him stir in their seats. That was it. Putin suspected everyone, even his closest advisors, and he was treating them just as Stalin had habitually denigrated his lieutenants. That's why they were present, to observe and sweat a little for Putin's amusement. But where was the August Gorelikov? Was he above suspicion? "Wait," slurred Nate as Bloken tightened his grip on the rebar. "There is one name I know. Conspirators meet at Blokhina's house, your mother's house, after the sailors leave." More stirring sounds behind him. The American would pay for his smart mouth. Bloken walked behind Nate's chair and looked at the three senior officials with a sneer. Bortnikov was fidgeting, whether from witnessing the beating or from anxiety was unclear. Patrushev's face was ashen. The Ph.D. and former engineer had no stomach for this. Egorova's handsome face was a disinterested mask. Her crossed legs were still. She looked bored. She was the only proven killer in the room, and since their New York trip, Loken had wanted to overpower her, then hogtie her, then break her bones. He would see if he could get her to vomit over Nash's beating. Openly opposing Egorova was not feasible now, especially if the rumors of her relationship with the president were true. Oh yes, Bloken had been briefed on many things. Besides the two guards, a young Kremlin aide with cat's eyes was standing against the wall, observing the Security Council members intently. He would doubtless report back to the president. And there were three smoked glass globes in the ceiling concealing cameras. Bloken scanned their faces again, turned and without any wind-up hit Nate from behind on the point of his right elbow, snapping the constraining cable tie, splitting open the olecranon, the tip of the elbow like a burst roasted chestnut, and subsequently dislodging the synovial joint between the head of the radius and the radial notch of the ulna. Nate's arm hung limply off the armrest, his elbow joint in pieces and severely dislocated. He would have been unable to lift his arm even if it had flopped into flame. Nate howled in pain but stopped himself, trembling, and managed a croaking laugh, which enraged Bloken, who swung the bar in a flat arc at Nate's left shoulder, not covered by the chair back, fracturing the acromion and shattering the coracoid process of the clavicle. The shock made Nate pass out with a spectral groan, and his head and chest flopped forward until restrained by the leather strap around his chest. Dominika and Patrushev got out of their chairs at the same time, but Patrushev strode to the door, slamming it behind him as he left. Weak stomach or guilty panic? Dominika instead walked around Nate to face him and raise his lolling head with a finger under his chin. She kept her face neutral. Bloken was watching her like a mastiff, but her heart beat wildly as she felt Nate's sweaty face and saw his eyebrows, cracked lips, and his closed eyelids, the eyelids she used to kiss to wake him up. No emotion? Show nothing, my God. She couldn't sit motionless and watch him be ground to a paste by this Spetsnaz maniac. She couldn't. She'd confess to save him. He'd be sent back and Forsyth could patch him up. It didn't matter what happened to her, but no. That's what this was, a trap. Nate would tell her so, Benford the same thing. Gable would bellow it from Valhalla. Stay whole, we're all spies, spooks, ferrets. Survival is worth any price. Defeating Putin's monstrous snake pit is worth anything, even if you have to watch Nate die. Forgive me, Dushka. Я люблю тебя всем сердцем. I love you with all my heart. She let Nate's head drop like a rejected melon at the market and turned to the young Kremlin toad.
Go immediately to the Kremlin and tell the president that this interrogation is an abomination, and that this subhuman piece of Spetsnaz shit will kill the American officer before he utters a word. She stamped her foot. Go. Go now, immediately.
She pointed at one of the armed guards.
You go with him to see he gets out of the prison without trouble. Do you hear me?
The guard and the Kremlin toad jumped as if scalded and ran out the door. Dominika turned to Blokin.
You animal. This American has important information, the identity of a mole operating inside our government, passing our most sensitive secrets, and you are breaking arms and legs with a steel bar. You are an imbecile.
Nate started moving his head and groaning, and Dominika went to a sink at the far end of the room to wet a cloth to wipe his face. Then she turned to see Blokin standing in front of Nate with a swagger, and Nate was saying something through parched lips and swollen tongue, and Blokin stiffened, then straightened, and raised the steel bar above his head, and Dominika saw Bortnikov leap out of his chair and scream no, but Blokin brought the rebar down on the right side of Nate's neck with an overhand chop, breaking his right clavicle in a compound fracture. The visible broken tip of the bone punctured the skin, and collapsing the vagus nerve inside the brachial plexus, causing global brain ischemia, a catastrophic interruption of blood to the brain, which resulted in Nate passing out again and slumping forward in his chair, and Bortnikov and the guard both grabbed Blokin's arms as he raised the bar to strike Nate again, and Dominika walked behind the guard, pulled the Burdish automatic pistol from the holster, racked the slide and pointed it at Blokin, whose eyes went wide. His exceptional reflexes turned his head almost out of the line of fire, but Dominika was too close, and she shot him twice in his shiny, scarred forehead, splattering both the prison guard and the horrified director of FSB with gray brain matter. Blokin collapsed face forward onto the floor. His head bounced twice on the tiles, his blood flowing out of his head neatly in two different directions into the two nearest drains, as his legs twitched involuntarily, because the frog's brain was dead, but his legs didn't know it, and Dominika watched as Bortnikov and the guard reeled unsteadily out the door, wiping the gore from their eyes, and Dominika wiped Nate's bloodied face, and mindful of the cameras in the ceiling, limited herself to attending to the prisoner. And the cold cloth revived him, and he opened one eye, then the other, but the pupils were two different sizes, and a small trickle of blood was coming out of his right nostril, and all Dominika could do was wipe his face and say to him, "American, are you all right?" And Nate's irises wobbled erratically in little circles. "You're safe now," he whispered to her. She heard the edge in her voice as she screamed, "Medic!" down the corridor, telling herself to control her panic, and the blood kept coming out of his nostril even though Dominika kept wiping it, and his breath was labored, and Dominika loosened the chest strap so he could breathe. But by the sound of his breaths, she guessed he was aspirating blood, and all she could do was wipe his cheek and say, "Medical attention is coming." But somehow knowing it wouldn't make a difference, and Nate's uneven eyes locked on hers, and there was a faint smile that passed over his lips, and his halo grew brilliant and radiated, and she felt the minute caress of one shattered finger touching her hand, a light touch brushing the top of her hand, just for an instant, unseen by the cameras, more intimate than a kiss. And he took two more deep breaths and went still, and his purple halo dissolved. And Dominika fought her tears, then heard footsteps pounding down the corridor even as Blokin's legs on the pinkish tiles wouldn't stop twitching. Dominika felt the nearly undetectable puff of air from the air vortex nozzle on her desk lamp, sitting on the corner of the desk in the director's office of SVR headquarters in the pine forest of Yasenevo. It indicated that a message from Benford had just come in. She positioned the flexible display and gauged the system by moving her eye in line with the integral optical reader that biometrically authenticated the pattern of her iris and began projecting the short message on the flat base of the lamp in a directional hologram. The scrolling letters were invisible to anyone not positioned exactly in line with the lamp and could be turned off with a casual wave of her hand. Though previously skeptical of the contraption, Dominika now marveled at the efficiency of the COVCOM device. Just this morning, she had undetectably used the digital lens in the lamp to photograph and transmit to Washington a top-secret read-and-return bulletin from the Security Council as the Kremlin courier respectfully waited 3 feet from her desk for her signature. There was even a self-destruct feature that would fuse the components in case of emergency. The SVR headquarters building, as Hersey predicted, was proving to be an efficient, massive antenna. The multi-paragraph message was not from Benford, but rather from Forsyth. Strange. 1. FYI. Magnet sentenced life imprisonment at Supermax Prison in Florence, Colorado. 2. Request advise current status Nash, including when feasible diplomatic initiative to bring home. Please advise possibility of swap. 3. Be advised Counterintelligence Chief Simon Benford retired. Forward his deep thanks and regards. Nate and Gable gone. Benford retired. She had never known any other CIA officers since her recruitment in Helsinki. They were her family, and their comforting presence mitigated the stark solitude of her life as a spy. Now she felt alone, even though she was at the pinnacle. She started drafting a reply, husbanding characters as she typed on the flexible display while her throat closed tight in despair. 1. Contact with President 2 nights per week. He sharing opinions of Siloviki, Patrushev now in disfavor. He discussing Russia clandestine alliances with Iran, North Korea, will advise. 2. Regret inform Officer Nash died as a result of injuries sustained during unauthorized interrogation. Diva. End. 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 With burning eyes and trembling lip, Dominica pushed send, and the message was transmitted. She remembered what Agnes had said. Nate came to rescue you, and I came to help Nate. So I suppose all of us lost. Everyone indeed had lost. But Dominica was running the SVR, and she moved inside the Kremlin. And astride President Putin, ironically back to her hated sparrow roots in a hopelessly febrile world without her Nate. She sighed and shuddered. Then Diva got back to work in her large office with the panoramic view of the pine forest and the endless horizon of her beloved Rodina.
The Kremlin's Candidate was written by Jason Matthews and read by Jeremy Bob. It was recorded by Bob Burrito and Demetrio Albano at Beat Street NYC, Ryan Lissy at Simon & Schuster Studios, Shayna Brown and Marty Lester at Shea Boom Audio in Austin, Texas, and John Hetrick at Brainstorm Media Inc. in Columbus, Ohio. Editing and post-production by Frog Pond Productions. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Elliot Rombach. The Kremlin's Candidate was produced and directed by Tara Thomas. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Kremlin's Candidate is available in print from Scribner. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio, Red Sparrow, and Palace of Treason by Jason Matthews and read by Jeremy Bob.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.